Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. The state of children's mental health has worsened over the past decade. Even those youth who have covered under private insurance do not have coverage for mental or emotional difficulties. The challenges of identifying and addressing teen mental health needs exclude many youth from receiving the intervention and treatment needed. One Hope United is a nonprofit organization investing in children and families for over 125 years. They serve over 10,000 children and families annually through educational services, behavioral health, and residential programs in Florida and Illinois. Juliana Harms, Executive Director of Behavioral Health at One Hope United, joins this edition of 411 Teen via the Zoom platform. She is in Normal, Illinois. Juliana, welcome to 411 Teen. We're so glad to be able to connect with you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to join, and I look forward to our discussion.
Okay. I'm getting ready to sneeze, so hold this for a minute. I feel it coming. I'm trying to hold it. I'm talking to Evan. Okay, I think I can. All right. Let me just start with the first question, Evan. Okay. Juliana, share with us and the listening audience, what is meant by teen mental health wellness? How does one identify it? What are we talking about?
Mental health wellness, well-being, and general mental health really is a broad stroke that encompasses the navigation of daily life in an optimal way. It means that youth and adults are able to navigate the surprises that life presents without really falling off course. That they are able to bounce back when there are disappointments. They're able to sort of learn life's puzzle and make the best of it and feel bright about it and be able to look forward to what's happening during the day. And there are sometimes events that can challenge that.
How do we identify it? Or do we identify it as just them having problems with their everyday? And what role does, if any, does culture play?
I believe that it's very important to understand a young person's baseline. This means that we as caregivers or an adult presence in a child's life, we're tuned into what's happening with them so that if there is a change, we're going to notice it. Sometimes the change may be subtle, sometimes it may be drastic. But the key is to check in with the youth who are in our lives and ask how they're doing. That compassionate inquiry is really so important on a daily basis. And culture does play a significant role with regard to mental well-being, the expression of having challenges, mm-hmm. perhaps not feeling very good, perhaps experiencing a problem that may be difficult to decipher as a young person. Mm-hmm. Sometimes culture does not encourage disclosure about
feeling
not so great or not knowing what to do on a daily basis to address feelings of sadness, of depression, of hopelessness. And those feelings can be tamped down and remain trapped. And the youth may feel like there's no way out, no way to solve those issues.
Do you have any suggestions or cues about crossing those cultural boundaries? I mean, because often the reluctance to disclose what is going on can be a major barrier. And it's not even so much that, you know, often psychologists will say, well, they're just in denial. It's not about denial. It's about the cultures and the boundaries within that particular culture.
The expression of emotion can be scary. It can be viewed by some cultures as demonstrating an undesirable vulnerability. And to get past that stigma, that tendency to look the other way, really modeling, an adult modeling what self-care is, what steps can be taken to increase mental wellness, mental health, that's really pivotal for young people these days. Youth observe, they become immersed in their environments. And when that environment shows support for the expression of both the good and the bad feelings that may be occurring, mm-hmm. and again, beyond feelings, mm-hmm. sometimes this is a whole body reaction. Mm-hmm. I really believe that that's pivotal, that modeling of seeking mental wellness is really important.
Just a general estimate, how many teens would you estimate have mental health wellness?
I believe that we are continuing to see a decline. Mm-hmm. We know from research that over the past decade, we have seen that decline, and that decline has been exemplified by expressions of, again, sadness, hopelessness, clinical diagnoses of depression, sometimes non-suicidal self-injury, and sadly, attempts to die by suicide. These have all increased over mm-hmm. the years. And there seems to have been, I shouldn't say there seems to have been, there has been a spike mm-hmm. since the pandemic. So that is a really interesting concept of truly trying to understand how many youth actually do feel that balance and mm-hmm. do feel that capacity, that resilience to move through the day in a healthy manner. I'm not sure we have a good finger on the pulse of that. But what we do understand is that we are in crisis and there are more and more youth who would benefit from clinical intervention.
When we look at these issues that the youthful population are experiencing, could you identify the main causes of youth mental illness? I mean, I think, you know, we talk about depression, we talk about anxiety, but what would you identify? With, you know, your long storied history of working with youth as the main causes of mental health issues in today's youth?
We really have a trifecta of domains that come into play. We recognize that there is a biological component, there is a psychological component, and then there is a more social component of mental health. So recognizing that there may be some innate factors that come into play that can impact mental health, I think it's pivotal to recognize that. Mm-hmm. But we're hearing youth express a sense of hopelessness, of seeing what's happening in the changing world and feeling like there's no good solution to remedy that, whether it's a socioeconomic crisis, whether it is televised international conflict, whether it's events in their own hometown, are not feeling like there's a light at the end of the tunnel. We also have that component of being saturated by the perfection of social media. And I most definitely don't want to vilify social media by any means. But when youth brains are saturated with, I keep going back to all of this perfection.
I'm glad to hear you saying that. Yes.
It's very easy to forget that some of these videos or sound bites take hours to prepare, and that it's not an in-the-moment event with all of its beautiful imperfection. What that comparison does is exacerbates loneliness, a feeling of, I'm not good enough. Look, there's always somebody better, and I'll never reach that ideal. And the isolation that can come from immersing oneself in social media, being alone in a room, having our brains become dependent upon that video after video after video to feel some sort of stimulation. I think it all comes into play to have a really significant impact on feeling mentally healthy.
Exactly. I know the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has identified anxiety and depression as major problems amongst the teens. And all of those variables that you have shared, I think, are contributing to this increase that we're seeing in anxiety and depression. What I'd like us to talk about when we come, we're going to take a brief break, that time is coming up, but just to kind of give you a heads up, is to look at the most at-risk children. What are these problems? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I'm talking with Juliana Harms. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. It's a weekly program for teens and families and educators, and it looks at a number of issues. Today, I am talking with Juliana Harms. She's the executive director of the Behavioral Health for One Hope United. Juliana, right before we went off, I was asking you, who are the most at risk for these problems of anxiety and depression that we are seeing?
Youth who do not have an environment that is supportive of who they are, how they express, understanding their interests, their challenges. When those supports are fragile or perhaps even non-existent, those youth can experience heightened anxiety, worry, concerns that there's no way to get better. We find that poverty can have an impact. And I hesitate to use the term poverty because it just these days has become such a
negative
catch-all. But anytime that there are financial stressors or resource stressors, that can heighten vulnerability to experience things like anxiety, excessive worry, cyclical thoughts of what's going to happen next. We also recognize that marginalized populations like the LGBTQI plus community, we recognize those youth are at higher risk of diagnoses of depression, of suicidality, of substance use, because of a lack of support, mm-hmm. because of, again, that environment not being supportive of who they are. So marginalized populations often experience higher rates of mental health concerns.
And the warning signals are signs that I've heard you say can be, it can be a number of things. It can be anxiety, depression, emotional lability, mm-hmm. Sleep. We didn't talk about that, but sleep, and we will get to it. Sleep issues, weight can also be a problem, weight and appetite. You mentioned mm-hmm. substance abuse. Just any type of change in their behavior. I often used to tell my clients, parents, if you're seeing a change in behavior, if it's a change in the way they dress, if it's a change in their eating habits, if a change in their sleeping habits, if it's a change in their attitudes about school, that change stays there. So everybody has a good day and a bad day. So we're not talking about those changes that are just for the day or so. But if it lasts a significant period of time, then we need to look at it. Would you agree with that, that characterization?
Wholeheartedly. My head is nodding and I'm like, absolutely. And that's where we go back to understanding the baseline of the youth, mm-hmm. because it's not one size fits all. Oh, there's a weight loss that's happened in a short amount of time. And so that is absolutely a red flag. It's a significant change or a subtle change that builds over time that is different from how that young person usually exists. And we have to tune into that and be alert to that and not be afraid to ask the hard question of, can you tell me what's happening? Mm-hmm. And be willing to be a non-judgmental listener when the answer comes.
You know, and so many resources I have read, they've identified the age of 14 as a typical age when mental illness is manifested. 14, the riskiest age. And I cannot understand that for a number of reasons. Would you agree with that? Have you seen, you know, the mental illness really occurring around? I mean, and there are going to always be exceptions, you know. 14, or what have you seen in your experience?
What we've learned from evidence-based research is that most adults today who experience mental health conditions mm-hmm. had symptomology that was surfacing around the age of 14. And I think that that's a compelling fact. But what we've seen within the service population of One Hope United, what I've seen as an individual practitioner, is that there is symptomology that does surface at that time. And again, I don't want to focus on pathology when I say symptomology, mm-hmm. but there is this crying out, this change that is becoming evident. But sometimes, and sadly many times, these changes or the behaviors are passed off as teen drama. And I think that that's been mm-hmm. pervasive over many, many years, over decades, that this is hormones. This is a teen trying to be an adult when they're still a child, trying to do things that they really shouldn't do at their age, which might be risky behavior. It might be, again, one of those changes that we see in a youth's life. So the worrisome component here is that rather than tuning in, we're saying, oh, this is typical, they'll grow out of it.
Right.
And yes. Not exploring further or asking more about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you talk about asking more about it, here we get into that communication. Because communication is a key to maintaining a viable relationship between teens and parents and caregivers. And one of the first things when you start, you know, to do a psychosocial work on what's happening in the home is we find that there may be a communication breakdown. Okay. Have you observed that?
Absolutely. And we have some sort of interesting parallel processes working here, because as we note that there's this flight from communication with our youth, preferring to text, preferring to send short videos, not interacting in person as much as has been done in the past, we as adults are experiencing that same sort of life event, where it's easier to pop a text than pick up the phone or even physically go see somebody in their room. So most definitely, I have seen this surface, and I do have the belief that individuals need to take a beat and say, I'm going to have a human interface today. I'm going to ask my young person, how are you? And that's one of the terms within One Hope United that we have coined is, you know, have you said hey to your youth today? Whether it's a young person in your life, whether it's somebody you're caring for, but that hey means how are you? Mm-hmm. And sometimes, again, we feel that pinch of having to have that face-to-face communication, but then also having a response to that and being a part of the holding of that response.
No, I'm thinking, what are the key challenges and solutions in addressing mental health needs of children and adolescents? And that communication breakdown, so to speak, you know, communication is not just me talking. It also involves you listening. Mm-hmm. And I find that the listening part, particularly with the adults, whether it's parents or caregivers, might be one of the weak areas. Not might, is one of the weak areas, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, you try to kind of be, you know, handle it gingerly, but the truth is that they aren't listening. They aren't listening. And and even with nonverbal communication can be very revealing. If you stay in tune and in touch with where that teen is coming from. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. We are losing our people skills. Mm-hmm. Adults and young people are. Again, it goes back to the isolation. It goes back to being focused on an electronic device. And we have lost that finesse, that ability to read the room. The term social intelligence is important terminology today. And we're really stifling the capacity of individuals to build that social emotional intelligence, to be able to know what's happening to others when I'm present, when I take up space, when I'm interacting with others, how is that impacting them? Mm-hmm. We also use that sight, that sound, that visual cue to feed our own psyche. It's a multi-sensory experience, and we've sort of chopped that apart, unfortunately. And then when we try to rejoin, it can be very uncomfortable, mm-hmm. and people don't quite know how to navigate that face-to-face interaction. So it's something that is cyclical. It feeds itself, and that's where we need to provide some sort of intervention to get that communication back mm-hmm. on track, have it be as natural as possible, and have there be that willingness to listen, as you noted earlier, that active listening and non-judgmental listening.
You know, the child welfare system presents with its own kind of, what I guess I would describe as unique system challenges. Foster care youth, youth who are within the system, are particularly susceptible to mental health issues. What's your take on that? How do you feel? Do you agree with that, or are you finding that to be the case, or am I overstating it?
I don't believe that you are overstating it at all. And it's not because there are youth who are flawed or problematic or pathological and then are associated with the child welfare system. The mere presence of a state child welfare or a county child welfare system in a child's life is traumatic. And sometimes the systems will only respond to those young people who have the most obvious outward signs, such as disruptions in a caregiver's home, whether that is could be home of origin or it could be a substitute caregiver's home, or there are disruptions at school. Then the answer is, let's link that young person with therapy, with counseling. But any youth who becomes involved with the child welfare system has some impact to their lives. And I think that this can be the genesis of issues later on, learning how to cope with those challenges, learning that it is okay to speak up and speak out when you're not feeling right or well. And that early intervention would be important. It would be great if no matter what, if a child had contact with the child welfare system, there was automatically a therapeutic support that was provided just so that child had a safe place to say, this is what happened to me and I don't feel good about it.
You know, one thing I have noticed, and maybe it's just here in this area, I don't really think so, but one thing I have noticed is that the child welfare workers, many of them, I would say the majority of them, and I don't mean this as a condemnation at all, fail to address that this child has a severe feeling of lack of control, particularly those in the system. They're losing every bit of control that they may have just being in that system. Have you seen that? I mean, they have no control all over almost anything.
So very true.
Okay.
That there is no secure place for them to be. Mm-hmm. One morning they wake up with a pillow that they know, a pet that they know, sounds and smells that they know. And in a matter of 8 hours, that can change. And there is no smooth termination of living at home, meaning there's no goodbye. There's no transition that's explained. It's an abrupt change. Child does not know where they're going to spend the night. And zeroing in on that observation of losing control is really important. And there are so many things that have to occur when the youth is transitioned from the home that sometimes the need to explain what's going on, to take time, that is overlooked. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the child feels any more in control, but they understand a bit more about what is happening. But absolutely, that need to move to the next compliance step is often the pitfall.
And adapt to this and adapt to that and, you know, change here and change there. I mean, I think that is a hell that they have to experience that I think we just forget to look at. I don't know. I don't think it's anything intentional, but I that's just some observation that I've had over the years. How do organizations like One Hope United intervene and provide support?
One Hope United has multiple domains where we are able to provide assistance. Mm-hmm. We are a child welfare agency, but we also are even more than that. We focus on the behavioral health needs of youth. We provide that external physical care for youth through residential care, through foster care. We also provide in-home supports for families that remain together but may still have a connection to the child welfare system. But within One Hope United, we carry the focus of, well, exactly what we've been talking about today, that young people who do become involved with large systems don't have that control. Mm-hmm. We need to take time to have that dialogue, show that compassionate inquiry, find out who this young person is and who their families are, mm-hmm. so that we can better design those interventions that are, well, that they're going to move us as a child welfare or a child and family serving agency out of their lives.
Juliana, this is one of those times I told you where I was going to have to interrupt. Hold your thoughts. I'll get right back at you. We're going to take a brief break.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You tuned in to 411 Team. Juliana, I had to interrupt you rudely. Again, my apologies, but I had kind of prepared you for it. But we were talking about generally just the interventions and the supports that One Hope United provide. And you were talking about that, I know, the domains.
And I think I was waxing poetic about One Hope United because I'm so impressed by the work mm-hmm. that is done on a daily basis and supports through substitute care, foster care, mm-hmm. Work with families who are intact but connected to the child welfare system, behavioral health supports. We work to view the families and children we serve as unique, as individuals, and not just focus on compliance tasks. So I think that is something that's very unique about One Hope United, that we are willing to examine the uniqueness and the individuality of the people we serve.
Share with us an example, you know, of what you're talking about, the listening audience, so they can put it in real concrete kind of terms as when you say, you know, what you actually do.
Those are efforts that are made by the different individuals who may be involved mm-hmm. in serving the families. Our caseworkers who are providing the daily social service interventions and maybe supporting foster care or, again, supporting those intact families, they are taking that extra step to ask questions, to sit down with the youths, with the caregivers, with the families of origin, and take time to discuss how does that family function? Mm-hmm. What does that family need? As opposed to filling out paperwork. And again, I'm talking the extreme here, but yeah. Filling out paperwork saying, here, this is what you need to do to be able to regain custody of your child or to take the next step with visitation, et cetera. It's a joined process, and it's a supported process that's fed by the expertise of the family, even though the family may be experiencing some challenges. And that's really pivotal. We don't see that a lot of times, but it's crucial.
What role do schools play? Where do you see them interfacing with all of this?
They are a critical player with regard to that fabric of care for youth. They're working with a child multiple hours a day. They are seeing the changes. They're hearing the outcry of the youth. They are synthesizing information, making recommendations. They are so important to making sure that needs are met, that we can't say enough about the impact that they have. When youth are in crisis, they're assessing that and they are linking the right resources. They're determining whether there's a need to call child protection. They're also working to provide that key component of education. So it really is such a multifaceted role, and it links to any work that's done by an agency like One Hope United or other state or local agencies that might be involved with the family.
I read where even some schools are incorporating what they call wellness rooms or oasis rooms. Are you familiar with that?
I have heard that this is a tool that is being used by schools so that youth have the ability to step out and step away to become more regulated. And I think it's a wonderful idea.
I do, too. I think it's just, it really indicates that they are trying to give them options to come to grips with what they may be experiencing, what the adolescents themselves may be experiencing. And just and they can do it right there, feeling pretty comfortable about doing it. Do you think that there is a stigma? Well, of course there is to some degree, a stigma still attached with mental health issues. Do you think that that stigma has diminished some? Because I find that today's teens are much more open to talking about how they feel. I'm feeling down, or this is happening, or that's happening. Now, it might just be a certain group of them, I don't know, but the teens that I've been working with are very open to saying they're having a bad day or they don't like this. They're very, have a lot of opinions about what's going on in the world and how that is indeed impacting them. What do you see as far as the stigma? I know I've talked about a number of things in saying this, but first of all, what's your take on the stigma of mental health issues?
That is a concept that I constantly roll over in my mind. That we are seeing, we're hearing young people talk more about mental health conditions. Again, where they are on a daily basis, if things are good, if things are bad, they're externalizing that. They are verbalizing that. I do think that stigma is present. I think it's significant. And perhaps this takes us back to that cultural consideration. And by culture, I mean race, ethnicity. It can be urban setting, suburban, small town, that family system construct. If there is permission that is given or there is modeling that is provided, that it is okay to externalize those thoughts about mental health and mental wellness and where am I today? I think we're more likely to hear those disclosures. On the other hand, I still believe that there is a significant amount of stigma attached that's preventing youth from expressing what's happening and preventing adults from expressing in much the same way.
We kind of touched on this earlier. But what? How do you see Madison Avenue, lack of a better term, impacting the youth of today? And I'm talking about the unrealistic models that they set up, that the young folks feel they need to emulate. You also see this in the social media, so we did touch a little bit on it. But I wanted us to explore that, wanted you to explore that a little bit more with the listening audience. Just the influence of unrealistic goals that's really out there. I want to look like her. And they don't know that, first of all, she's going through hell to look like that, okay? And it's not healthy. And it's not, you know, you don't need to look like that. Being comfortable with self. I hear the groan. I know. And I thought, well, let me ask her. I mean, everybody else has that groan. I mean, I groan too. But, you know, just, you know, kind of tapping into where you are and where you sit and what you think. What's your philosophy on that? How do we get them to realize that this isn't real? That, and, you know, that they can be independent. They don't always have to follow the end group, because that's another part of it, their own self-concept.
Yes. All I can say is yes. It is, saturation is the term that's pinging in my head. Mm-hmm. Saturation. Back in the day, we had magazines that we would thumb through, and we would sometimes see on television that slice of life, but now it's everywhere, and it's what you're supposed to want. It's supposed to be your ideal, and we can't get away from it because, again, social media. But that expectation that this is perfection, and I think connect to this, and not to go off on a tangent, but it's that dichotomous thought of our young people today having this image of, hey, it's okay to be unique. It's okay to be different. It's okay to live your own life the way you want to live it. Yet we know that snapback of, but this is still how you're supposed to look, and this is what you're mm-hmm. supposed to want. And no, you really don't have that freedom. And peers punish peers for being different, or maybe even not being different in the right way. So I don't think it's anything that we've conquered over the years. Mm-hmm. Intensified that need to reach an ideal, an unattainable ideal of body image, clothing style, makeup perfection, hair, that which is essentially us, our talents that we may or may not have. We've done nothing to lessen the impact of not being able to reach that ideal. Mm-hmm. And that worries me mm-hmm. so very much.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with you. The pandemic brought a lot of economic hardships. It disrupted their learning. They had less in-time person-to-person kind of, relationships, whether it was with teachers or with families or with friends. Do you feel that the young folks are still dealing with the fallout of these challenges, figuring out where they are, where they're going? We always talk about getting back to normal. How do we accomplish this?
I don't see that we will ever be where we were with regard to what we might consider traditional or daily event or expected when it comes to work, school, socializing, etc. The financial impact most definitely felt by individuals, both young people and adults. But what I found in my discussions with adolescents with whom I've worked, with adolescents we're working with at an agency level, is that this major milestone or milestones have been missed within that anchor of school or the education system. Because life often was gauged by the school year, by that 9 months, what happened during those 9 months. And you physically went to school and you came home and you had something that you could count on and you saw your peers. So you had that interface and that social interaction with both young people and adults. And what young people are telling me is that they've lost a sense of time and they don't really even know who their peer groups are anymore because they would not see them in person on a daily basis. And for those young people who are at that age of perhaps leaving middle school or junior high and then going into high school, that may have a bunch of other young people that they didn't know, there's no concrete transition. So they feel adrift and not very secure in their social interactions.
Any suggestions that you may provide to parents, adults, society, whatever, to help them to better prepare youth of today? Any suggestions that you think they may do? Words of wisdom that you may share that we before we close?
I see that need for the check-in with the youth as so very important. And it's not only a caregiver or a person in the household, but it's a person in the youth's life. And it goes back to that, have you said hey to your young person today? That hey meaning how are you? But also being willing to hear that answer. And to be able to take steps to link resources. But self-care that's modeled is also extraordinarily important. So if caregivers are demonstrating ways that they're managing their mental well-being, that's going to be observed by youth, and those habits are going to be picked up as well. So I think that those are two elements that could perhaps serve as an assist for helping a youth along the mental wellness journey.
Okay. In this last minute, is there a particular resource or site or app or whatever that you might suggest for the listening audience, those who want to take this a little step further? Is there any resource you would refer?
I believe that there are a number of apps that can benefit all members of a household with regard to regulation of emotions, that reminder to be self-reflective. And I almost would hate to narrow the field because there are so many good apps that are available. But one that allows space to sit and reflect on the day, and I don't want to sound too cheesy, but really that allows that space to just sit and be still is extraordinarily important. Because that's what we weed out during our busy day, that ability to sit and let our brains rest, let our hearts rest, okay. And just be.
Well, thank you. It is time out for this edition of 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I have been talking with Juliana Harms, Executive Director of Behavioral Health at One Hope United. Thank you so much. To my listening audience, much appreciation for your time and your ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Team at WFSU.org.